Okay, I want you to try something for me. Close your eyes for a second, seriously, just for a moment.
All right, I'm doing it.
Now, picture the house you grew up in. You know, the front door, maybe the smell of the kitchen, that one weird stain on the carpet.
Oh, yeah, I'm seeing the yellow wallpaper in our old hallway vividly.
Okay, you can open your eyes. So here's the question that has caused, I think, probably the biggest headache in all of human history.
Which is
Where was that image?
physically, you mean? Where was it located?
Exactly. Because if you ask a neuroscientist or, you know, a computer scientist building the latest AI, they'll point right to your head. They'll say that memory is a file. It's stored in a neuron, encoded in some protein sitting inside that 3-pound lump of wet meat in your skull.
Right. That's the standard view. The brain is a container. It's basically a hard drive.
But what if it's not? What if looking for a memory inside your brain is like trying to find the announcer inside your radio?
That is a deeply unsettling thought.
It is, isn't it? But that is exactly what we're unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into Henri Bergson's 1896 classic, Matter and Memory.
But not just as a historical text. We're looking at it through that new analysis from Sage Mind that just dropped.
That's right, the February 2026 piece, Bergson on Perception and Memory.
And I have to say, reading this in 2026, it just hits differently.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because we are so obsessed right now with this idea that intelligence is just data processing. You know, we have these massive AI models, and the thinking is, okay, if we just cram enough data into the container, consciousness will eventually, pop out.
We treat the mind like a storage unit.
And Bergson comes along from over a century ago and says, you have got it completely backwards.
Completely
He
backward.
argues the brain stores, well, nothing.
Nothing.
At least when it comes to what he calls pure memories, yeah, is the brain is not a warehouse. It doesn't preserve the past.
Okay, see, I'm already skeptical. If my brain isn't storing my memories, then I need to know where they are and why I can remember my password but forget my anniversary.
And we will get there. But to understand memory, Bergson says you first have to understand what the brain is actually for. And to do that, you have to redefine what matter even is.
Okay, this is the heavy philosophy part, right? The whole concept of the image.
It is, but don't let the word scare you. Bergson's basically stepping into this huge philosophical cage match between two ideas, realism and idealism.
Give me the quick and dirty version.
Okay, so the realists say the world is made of objects, hard physical matter. If you leave the room, the table's still there. It's independent of you.
Seems reasonable.
Then the idealists say, no, everything's in the mind. The table only exists because your mind perceives it. It's a mental construction.
The classic, if a tree falls in the forest problem.
Right. And Bergson looks at both and says they're both missing the point. So he introduces this idea of the image.
But he doesn't just mean a picture in your head.
No, not at all. He's saying the universe is an aggregate of images. Matter itself is made of images.
Wait, hold on. The universe is an aggregate of images. That sounds a little like we're living in a simulation. Is he saying reality isn't real?
No, actually quite the opposite. He's trying to get more real. Think of it this way. For Bergson, an image is something that's more than just a representation in your mind, but it's also less than a totally separate, disconnected thing.
Okay.
It's something that exists, but it exists in relation to everything else.
Yeah.
But here's the crucial part. In this whole soup of images that is the universe, there's one image that's special. It's unique.
Let me guess. My body.
Your body, exactly.
Why? Because I have a soul or I'm conscious or something.
Not yet. It's much simpler. Your body is what he calls a privileged image because it's a center of action.
A center action.
Yeah. I mean,
Okay.
think about a rock. A rock just sits there, forces act on it, it reacts. But your body, it receives input, light, sound, touch, and it can pause, it can hesitate. It chooses how to respond with movement.
So my body's kind of a filter for the world.
It's a lens. And this leads to his most radical idea about perception. We think perception is about gaining knowledge, right?
Yeah, seeing what's out there.
Bergson says no, absolutely not. Perception isn't for knowledge, it's for action.
So I don't see the world as it really is.
You see the world as it relates to what you can do with it.
Okay, I need a concrete example here. I feel like I'm seeing this whole room, the mic, the wall, my coffee cup.
Are you seeing tool, obstacle, drink? I mean, imagine you're walking through a forest. A botanist sees 30 different species of plants. A hungry person sees edible or poisonous. A person running from a tiger just sees hiding spot or barrier.
So perception is a process of subtraction. I'm ignoring most of reality.
It's a sieve. That's the reflection analogy from the Sage Mind article. Your body is like a mirror, but it only reflects the parts of the universe, the data that concern its possible actions.
That's a huge point for AI, isn't it?
How so?
Well, when we train an AI, we force feed it everything, every pixel, the entire data set. But Bertson is saying a living mind does the opposite. It actively ignores 99% of reality just to survive.
That's a brilliant connection.
Yeah.
An AI builds a map of data. A living thing builds a map of action. Perception is just virtual action. It's your body sizing up the world.
Okay, so if perception is just my body getting ready to act, that brings us to the main organ for action, the brain.
The brain.
And this is where I need you to walk me through that telephone exchange metaphor, because this is where I start to get a little uncomfortable with all this.
It goes against everything we're taught, I know. We're told the brain generates consciousness. Bergson says, no, the brain is a central telephonic exchange, a switchboard.
Purely a connector, then.
Its job is to receive a signal from a sensory nerve and route it to a motor nerve. Input becomes output.
But it must do more than just route the calls. It has to process them, right?
It analyzes the movement it receives and selects the movement to be executed. But, and this is the absolute key, it does not fabricate the picture. The brain doesn't create the image of the world. The world is already out there as an image. The brain just connects your body to it.
The text mentions the scalpel argument to prove this.
Yeah, it's a thought experiment. Bergson says, okay, imagine you cut the nerves going from your eyes to your brain. What happens?
Vision goes black, which to me proves that the brain was making the image.
That's the standard materialist conclusion. You broke the projector, so the movie stopped. But Bergson says no. The perception vanishes because your body has lost its power to act on the object.
Say that again.
The image of the cup is still out there in the universe of images, but your body can no longer touch it or react to it. You cut the wire to the switchboard. The switchboard didn't create the voice on the line. It just connected the call.
Okay. I can sort of see that for perception. I see the cup. I grab it. Brain connects the two. But memory.
Ah, yes. The fortress of the mind.
This is where the switchboard analogy really breaks down for me. I can sit here with my eyes closed and replay a memory. I'm not acting. I'm not moving. If the brain is just for action, how does it do that?
This is the absolute pivot of the entire book. Bergson says we're all confused because we lump two totally different things together under the single word memory.
The two memories.
Correct. There is habit memory and there's pure memory. And mixing them up is why we can't solve the mind-body problem.
Yeah, let's break that down. Habit memory first.
Habit memory is basically your body learning a motor skill. Think about learning to type. Or learning a poem by heart.
Okay, yeah. You repeat it over and over again.
Until it becomes automatic. Your mouth just moves. Your fingers just move. It's a mechanism. Bergson says this isn't really memory in the way we usually mean it. It's a motor habit stored in your body, in your nervous system.
And it's forward-looking. I learn it so I can do something later.
Exactly. But then there's pure memory.
Which would be?
The memory of the very first time you read that poem. The specific afternoon.
Yeah.
The light in the classroom. That event happened once. It has a date stamped on it. You can't repeat it like a habit.
Because it's in the past. It's over.
It is the past. And this is the jump. Bergson argues that while habit memory is in the body, pure memory is, well, it's spirit.
Oh, spirit. That's a loaded word in 2026.
It is. But he doesn't necessarily mean it in a, you know, a religious or ghostly sense. He just means it's non-material. It's not a physical thing stored in a physical cell. It represents the past. While the body only ever acts in the present.
So scientists are making a category error. They're looking for pure memories in the brain's hardware.
Precisely. They're looking for the movie file of your childhood inside a machine that was only ever built to move your muscles.
Okay, but if my childhood memory isn't in my neurons, where is it? This brings us to that famous diagram, right? The cone.
The inverted cone. Yeah, we have to try and visualize this. Imagine a cone, but it's standing on its tip.
Got it. Ice cream cone. Point down.
And that sharp point at the bottom, which he calls S, is just touching a flat sheet of paper. That paper is the plane P. That's the present moment. And that's reality right now.
And the tip of the cone MS.
That's your body. The single point of view that is in contact with the present where perception and action happen.
Okay, so what's the rest of the cone? The big, wide base hovering up in the air?
That's AB. That's the past. That is pure memory. It just hangs there, motionless, containing your entire personal history.
So all my memories are just hovering above me in this metaphorical cone.
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah.
But here's the crucial part. It's not static. It's a dynamic process. For a memory to become useful, for you to actually recall it, It has to descend.
Down the cone.
Right. It starts at the wide base of what he calls a nebula. It's cloudy, virtual, abstract. Mm. As it moves down toward the tip, toward the present, it condenses. It tightens into an actual image that can inform your current action.
It has to materialize to be useful.
Exactly. It has to go from being a ghost to something that can drive the bodily machine. And Berg says our mental health is basically just how well we manage this movement up and down the cone.
What do you mean manage the movement?
Well, think of someone who lives too much at the base of the cone up in the AB section. They're just dwelling in their memories, totally detached from the present.
The dreamer.
Right. All depth, no action. Now, what about the opposite? Someone who lives entirely at the tip, at point S, just reacting, moving, reacting. No past, no reflection.
The impulsive, the automaton.
Doesn't that sound just a little familiar?
Oh, wow. Yeah. That is the attention economy the SageMind article was getting at. We're being engineered to live only at the tip of the cone. The infinite scroll, the constant notifications. It's all point us. Just react. Don't access the deep past.
We are becoming, as Bergson put it, conscious automatons. We have perception, but we're losing the duration, the weight of the past that gives it meaning.
That is actually profound. So a healthy mind, good sense, is being able to bring just enough of that pass down the cone to inform the present action.
Precisely. It's a tension. It's a balance.
But I still have to push you on the metaphysics of this. I'm stuck on the where. If the brain doesn't store the past, how does the past still exist? Where is it?
This is the hardest hurdle for us because we're obsessed with space. We think if something exists, it has to exist somewhere.
Right. Like a file in a cabinet.
Bergson just asks, why? Why do we assume the past ceases to exist just because it's no longer the present?
Because it's gone.
Is it? Think of a spool of thread. As you unwind it, the part you've already unrolled is still there. It still exists. It's just not the part you're looking at right now. Time, for him, is an accumulation. The past preserves itself.
So memory isn't a drawer I open. It's a dimension I access.
Yes. And it's a difference in kind. A memory isn't just a weakened perception. It's not a faded photo in your head. It's a virtual state that becomes actual only when your brain's motor mechanisms call on it.
Okay, but I have a very practical objection. Brain damage.
The aphasia argument.
Exactly. We know if you damage a specific part of the brain, people lose memories. They lose words. If the memory isn't in the brain tissue, why does destroying the tissue destroy the memory?
This is where Bergson thinks his theory actually works better. He points to cases where people lose the ability to speak, but the words clearly aren't gone.
How would you know they aren't gone?
Because in a moment of shock or high emotion, the words can suddenly come flooding back. Or they can understand a word when someone else says it, they just can't produce it themselves.
So the file wasn't deleted?
He argues the brain lesion didn't destroy the memory itself. That's safe in the past, in the cone. What it destroyed was the motor mechanism, the switchboard connection that lets that virtual memory ring the bell of action in the present.
So it's like my keyboard is broken, the internet is still there, the website is still there, I just can't type in the address to get to it.
That's a perfect modern analogy for it. The body can no longer find the physical attitude to call up the image. The link is broken, not the content.
That is...
yeah.
Strangely hopeful.
It is. It suggests our mental life is vast and mostly intact, and the brain is just this valve, a reducing valve that only lets a tiny trickle of our spirit through, just enough for the practical purposes of survival.
A reducing valve. So without a brain, we'd be overwhelmed, remembering everything all at once.
Maybe. Or we just wouldn't be able to focus on the now long enough to act.
This completely flips the whole script on, you know, uploading your consciousness to the cloud.
It suggests you can't. If you map every neuron, you're just mapping the switchboard.
Yeah.
You haven't captured the caller. You haven't captured the past, the spirit.
Okay, so let's bring this all back to Earth, back to the plain P of 2026. What's the main takeaway from all this?
I think there are three huge shifts. First, stop thinking of your brain as a hard drive. It's a connector, not a container.
Second, realize that your perception is fundamentally biased. You don't see reality, you see utility. You see a map for action.
And third, appreciate that tension of memory. The world wants to keep us at the tip of the cone, just reacting.
Attention to life.
Yes. To be fully human, in the Bergsonian sense, means doing the hard work of climbing up and down that cone, bringing the depth of your past into the present moment.
Which leads to that final kind of spooky thought Bergson leaves us with. He's a dualist. He thinks matter and spirit are two different things.
He does. The brain is matter. pure memory is spirit. They touch, they interact, but they aren't the same stuff.
And the implication is?
Well, if the memories aren't stored in the molecules of the brain, then when the brain finally breaks down, there's no logical reason, according to him, to assume the memories just vanish.
If the radio breaks, the broadcast might still be on the air.
Exactly. It's a provocation, for sure. But in an age where we're so convinced we're just biological machines, it's a fascinating and maybe necessary alternative.
I think I'm going to need some time to descend my cone and process all of that.
Take your time. Don't be an automaton.
Sage advice. Yeah. Thanks for diving deep with us on Matter and Memory. We'll catch you on the next one.